This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today is August 12th, 2019, and I'm with Ron Creer at his home on Douglas in Juneau. Could we begin just by having you restate your name for me and tell me a little bit about where you were born?
I'm Ron Creer. I was born in Sheboygan, Michigan. Moved to Massachusetts when I was just a wee bairn. Moved to Rhode Island. My father was in the Coast Guard. And I grew up there for the most part. And my best bud at the time, parents were Arctic archaeologists. And they invited me to come north with him, with them. And I guess that was in 65 or thereabouts.
How old were you at the time?
14 to 15. So I spent, almost 6 months in the Arctic, and came back, and then to Rhode Island, which seemed really tiny after being in Alaska. And then when I graduated from high school, I was still into archaeology, so I did some archaeology work in British Columbia, but ended up at the university in Fairbanks, where I met all the hobbits, who were not yet hobbits.
What were your first impressions of them? And who were the people that you met?
Well, Greg and Fred were impressive just by their size and their they were big guys, heavily bearded. Even at that point in time, most 18-year-olds weren't packing big beards. And Van Sundberg was there, and I think Roy Cart, Jimmy Mahan, Daw, Paul Johnson, just a whole bunch of folks. In fact, I met my Barb and Dennis's brother in Fairbanks, Monk, as we called him, his name was Mike, before I met either of them and before I had been down to Indian Islands. But so yeah, there was a connection there very early on.
And do you think that the 6 months you spent in the Arctic had any sway on you ending up in Fairbanks?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think Robert Service said something to the effect that Alaska is the last place you want to send a young man because it will ruin the rest of the world for him. Something to that effect, anyway. So yeah, so I just kind of bided my time until I could get back to Alaska. And the University of Fairbanks accepted me, so there I was.
And what do you think it was about Alaska that was so special to you?
Well, it's really hard to explain it, but certainly the land, the enormity of it. We spent a lot of time with Woodland and Inupiat, and being with them was transformational in a lot of ways. I think at an early age I learned that you take what you need and you leave the rest. And just a lot of things, learning by doing, that sort of thing. But mostly the land, the life, the it's just mind-boggling. Still is.
Did you grow up living pretty closely to the land?
Well, I grew up in Rhode Island, which, of course, isn't usually thought as such. But yeah, we lived on the shore. My dad was in the Coast Guard, so by the water or in wooded areas. So yeah, I had always had an affinity for being out of doors.
And then what I forgot to ask, what did your parents do?
My father was a lifelong service member of the Coast Guard. My mom was a mom, but she worked as well. She worked for the local police department in Bristol, Rhode Island, where I went to high school. She worked at a restaurant, lobster restaurant. She was socially active and helped organize the 4th of July parade and that kind of stuff. But it was kind of, we lived on base, so it was a kind of a military brat thing watered down because it was Coast Guard.
And did you have siblings?
I had a sister. I have another sister in Texas and an older half brother.
So, okay, you were at University of Alaska Fairbanks. You met the what who people who would be the Hobbits, and then what happened after that?
Well, I flunked out almost immediately. I was having way too much fun. I think it was the ROTC thing that was, but anyway, so I think it was that was 70, sometime in the 70s. I had to go back to Rhode Island, and pay my dues. Went to Roger Williams College there, actually went to school and did all the things you're supposed to, and then returned to Fairbanks. I was kind of on the fence. There was a lot of things to do, and I've always was interested in archaeology, and there was work I could have done there. But a friend who had been the resident advisor for us at the dormitory showed up at my house in Rhode Island, my parents' place, and convinced me to come back to Alaska.
Why do you think they did that?
Why did he do that?
Yeah.
I think Tom knew I needed to be in Alaska. Yeah. He had come back east to see his parents, but and then drove down from Boston and picked me up. Freaked my poor parents out, frankly. He showed up in this massive yellow cat. He looked like a pimp, massive yellow Cadillac. He had a Captain America long sleeve shirt. So this is sometime in the 75 or something like that, and star spangled pants, yellow leather shoes, and long curly blonde hair. Yeah, my parents are pretty conservative, but not that conservative. But anyway, it was quite. My mom was kind of like, "That's Tom I told you about," and so, but anyway, yeah. So we got on a plane and flew back to Alaska.
And did you go back to
I
school?
did go back to school. Yes.
And what were you studying?
Anthropology and archaeology, ethnography.
And did you end up graduating?
Eventually. I got a master's degree in anthropology, and then I spent most of my time. At that time, I had been making trips down here, and I had gone commercial fishing. This is a deckhand, just messing around. And I got interested in communication between fishermen and communication networks and how they passed on information in different ways and how they entertained themselves as well. But when I came back after the first summer that I had collected all of these recordings and stuff, my professor told me that I needed to that occupational ethnography was not. She wanted me to deal with a native culture in Alaska kind of thing. So I stopped doing that.
So you were interested in fishermen.
And how fishermen organized themselves. And then the Hobbit Hole was an interesting place for that because there was a cluster of people that were fishing very close together, and they had a pretty tight social involvement outside of the fishing thing. So how the interactions between them and how they coded and transmitted information during that whole period of time, there was an evolution in how things worked. You know, you'd have codes over, and you're communicating over a CB radio or a VHF radio, and then there were scramblers that came on board, so somebody that had the right receiver could hear you, but everybody else would just hear squawk kind of deal. And then I got out of that little bit of research before the before cell phones came online.
And why was communication important between fishermen?
Well, you gotta be where the fish are, and if you aren't there, somebody else might be. So most fishermen had a, for lack of a better term, a coding group. People that they knew, and they had ways of transmitting information as well as they could. Just for an example, the Hobbit Hole, folks developed a wheel, a two-disc wheel. And on that you had green pickles, or green pickles and ham, or something like that. And then you'd have a sheet that would tell you the green pickles and ham. So the inside ring was places, where the general area where most of the fleet was fishing. And the outside ring was information on what was being caught and how many, kind of thing. So you'd say, oh, how are things going today? Oh, green eggs and ham. I saw a bluebird. And you'd do the spinning on the magic dial there, and you'd know that they were at Icy Point and they had caught 50 fish. That kind of thing.
Was that to just share information or to also help other people and tell them that this is a good spot for fishing?
Both. I mean, yeah, I mean, it was information of value, without a doubt, and you'd only be transmitting it to somebody that was in your, that had the other, that had a disc that could translate it. And then with scrambling, it became much easier. But oftentimes, you know, it gets complicated because you also have to weigh fisherman B is down here off of Hocktaheen where there's 30 hungry boats. And if he suddenly goes steaming off, you know, in the direction of the Fairweathers or up the coast towards Icy Point or something like that. So there were all sorts of, you know, things that guys did and gals did to, and I don't know, now with cell phones and stuff. And then there's the competition issue, you know, if there's just not that many fish, you might not be calling back when somebody asks you how things are, that kind of thing. A lot of intricacies to it.
When did you actually end up or living at the Hobbit Hole? Do you remember what year that was? Or when in your life, I guess?
Well, there was no studio. There was still the dog room on the house. So it was sometime in the 70s, mid-70s, something like that.
So just a few years after they bought the place?
Yeah, they bought it in, I can't remember when they bought it. So that must have been, it was before the Exxon Valdez thing. So it must have been 72 or 3, something like that. So it was soon after that. You know, I came out for a little while and went back to Fairbanks. And so, and all of that was after I got back from Rhode Island with Tom. So, yeah, 73, something like that. I was probably closer to 74 when I started coming down a lot. And then I stayed down here. And then I went back to Fairbanks and got my master's degree. But I didn't get that until the 90s, and I was actually married to Barbara by then and living in Washington, aching to get back to Alaska. So, what was the question?
Or when, do you remember what year?
Let's see, you know, it'd have to be sometime in the mid-70s, somewhere in there. Reba was still living there. So it was largely, it was Greg, Reba, and I for, I don't think that was the first year I wintered over, I think. And then even after that, when I was living in town, would regularly go out in the winter time and whenever I could. But there was several years where I was just fishing. I crewed with Greg on the Quest when he and Kim were together. And then I fished with Greg when he had the Kita. And then I fished with my brother-in-law after I got married to Barbara. Soon after that.
And what was it that first brought you to the Hobbit Hole?
I think it was the FV Nova.
Which is?
It was a tender that ran between Juneau Cold Storage and Elfin Cove in the outside. And it was, Paul Johnson was the master of the Nova. Greg worked on that too, because Greg worked in the canneries in Juneau. Matter of fact, on that little map I gave you, there's a place called Nova Beach that is where Greg ran the Nova aground when he was on watch coming from Juneau. So they were heading out through the pass here to go to Elfin Cove, and Greg, I don't know if he would have told you the story, he kind of dozed off and put the boat up on the beach right here.
You did not tell me that story.
Yeah, no, he wouldn't. Who would? Some asshole friend, you know.
So you just hopped on the.
Oh yeah. Which is when I was in Juneau, I was staying with Jim Mahan. I just went down to the dock. I'd get on the Nova and I'd run out here. And periodically, you know, you go back to town on the boat too. Sometimes at the end of the season. Because they were running fish back and forth. Or you'd fly in. Or catch some other fishermen going in.
And what was going on in your head the first time you saw the Hobbit Hole?
Well, it's just so idyllic. I mean, you're standing there even then before it was all, you know, gussied up as it is now, it was just like, this is so sweet a spot. I mean, from, you know, the whole standpoint of the anchorage and just the dynamic nature of these islands in their own right, and this area in particular, you know, the currents, just everything was just mind-blowing. It still is. The other cool thing about it was, I mean, there's tons of Dungeness crab in there. I mean, you throw the crab pot over. I mean, there was just everything aplenty. And it needed people to take care of it. So.
What were some of the things that you did while you were living there?
Oof.
A lot, probably.
Yeah, a fair amount, you know, for the first, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. So I did a lot of garden work, helped build the big greenhouse that was in the upper garden.
And had you done gardening before?
Oh, yeah, I've gardened all my life. I also, of course, as Doris Howe pointed out that there was a really very nice little rock garden right by the house. It was one of the only, and it had a little garden on the front of it. Well, I dug up everything that was in there, including all the bulbs and perennials that were in there to plant other stuff. And Doris made a point of, yeah, anyway, painted the buildings. We tore out the house needed to have, you know, new, The whole foundation of it was rotting out, so all that needed new woodwork, and we had a Greg got a sawmill, so we milled cants to put under the warehouse and underneath the. So you get involved in anything and everything that's going on, really.
And you were fishing during this time as well.
Well, you know, early on, I was just a beach bum. Greg was fishing the Windrush, his dad's little sailboat. I think Reeb was fish might have been fishing with him. Fred had, oh, I think he had the Venture then. So they were all going out and hand trolling. So I pretty much just punked around on the beach and had a grand old time doing stuff. And then I'd go fishing on occasion. And then after Greg got the Quest, he and Kim fished it, and I'd occasionally fish it to when Kim wanted a break to be on the beach. I'd fish on the Van, and I fished on God, what was the Aimley L, Fred's wooden double ender that he got after the Venture. I'm pretty sure it was the Venture, but anyway. So yeah, I just kind of kick around and fish a little bit with folks, and there's so much to do on the beach. Smoking fish for one thing, and there's always work to do, one sort or another. So the big projects, though, we're certainly doing the work on the house and the warehouse, and then the pipeline and the hydro project. Dennis and I brought the. Everybody wanted to. We were all interested in, for the most part, anyway. Greg and Kim then, and Fred and I, and folks that were spending the most time there, were interested in, having gardens and stuff like that. And we had chickens and a variety of chickens and roosters. And we got pigs. Dennis and I brought two piglets up from Port Townsend. It was an interesting trip for the pigs. We built a little shed for them on the stern of the LE4, so that had to have been in the early 90s. And they were fractious creatures. Little piglets are. They hate, they squeal and they don't like anybody, and they want mama and all this. And they're just, well, after a few days of them being on the fantail of the LE4, and we were in some big water. They were really friendly after that. They'd eat anything you gave them. They didn't fuss at all, and they were wildly excited about getting on the beach and all of that stuff. But
And what happened to them?
they became food.
And then were there pigs after them?
No,
They're the last two?
no. They oh, there's it's a horrible story about the pigs, the demise of the pigs. There was even a snuff film involved with it, but they were allowed to grow too large, to the point where, well, when you harvest animals, you want them to be at a prime point, not, morbidly obese like poor Brownie and Spot were by the time they went away. But they would have been much better eating earlier in their lives if they were going to be. I advised them not to be named. Try not to name my food, but this Spotty and Brownie, they got sick. And my dad lived on his family raised swine, so my dad, I called him up and he gave me all sorts of advice about what to do because these poor animals were sick. He wanted me to get chunks of coal, give them coal to chew on, and if we didn't have any coal, some charcoal. And then I described what was going on with them. He said, "Oh, that's an iron deficiency. They need iron." And so we called up to the vet, and by this time they're about as big as this table in length, 4 feet long, and you couldn't put your arm, I couldn't put my arms around them. They were big animals, but they were had no energy. They were just laying there in their little deals. So I called the vet, told them what we needed, how much we needed, and they sent it out. But they sent it out. They didn't give us a needle that was sufficient to for a pig, for any large animal, because they've got a lot of hide on them. So they had these little tiny things that you'd do, and you had to stab the pigs. They're both like just conked out laying in their deal. And I came up to him and I stuck Brownie, I think it was, and he exploded out of the sty, just, ah! screaming and banging around, which got the other pig excited, and I managed to get it, the second needle into her, and they just went crazy. I was screaming and yelling and bashing into stuff. I thought they were going to kill me, but they got better.
But no pigs after that.
No pigs after that. I wish I could remember the fellow's name. A gentleman came over from Gustavus. He had to have been in his 70s or 80s then. And he knew how to slaughter pigs as well as other animals. The whole process of boiling them. Anyway, he commented on that they needed to be harvested a little sooner. So yeah, no more pigs. Hmm. No more pigs. Then the next livestock they got after that. Well, we had geese for a little while. What was ducks? Hmm. Was there still a duck there when you were?
Yeah, three ducks.
And three ducks. Oh, was one of them the lonesome duck? The last of the khakis that Kim and Greg had before they sold the place?
Maybe. The ducks are named Lincoln, Spotty, and Brownie.
I don't remember what the lonesome duck was called. But it was the one that would actually come up to you. It wanted companionship. If you were laying down in the grass, it would come over and get right next to you and pluck. Probably gone.
How would you describe the community at the Hobbit Hole? I mean, I guess, what was it like living there?
It was like a big fish camp. Well, it was a fish camp. I mean, ultimately, it was, you know, in the early years, none of those people, nobody knew how to fish, to speak of. Weren't familiar with the gear, and certainly weren't familiar with the area. So there was a lot of hit and miss. Community. I'm trying to think about how that really worked. A lot of time was spent by there were times when there'd be 10 or 15 boats on out on the dock. I remember our photographs where it's just a nest, you know, just a thicket of masts and stuff, you know, when it was party time and stuff. But at some points when people were fishing close to the islands in the passes, so to speak, and they weren't down at Hocktaheen or up the coast or something like that, you could have 20 people for dinner. And the place would be packed with people. And it was all great. It was great fun. But there were people living there, too, that weren't living on their boat. So there was a lot of I think that made for a lot of challenges for certainly the people that were living on the beach. People stay up late playing guitars in the living room, and or in the kitchen was tiny, you know, in the early days, but you'd have 15 people in there. It was just about as big as this little alcove. So the community was, when there was heavy lifting to do, you got a lot of hands, but there were always slackers. Mm. I was working in the gardens one morning. So, you know, you get up early in the morning, especially if you're fishing out of the hole, like out in the passes. So people would North Island was a big spot to fish. And then the passes here and out at Three Hill and whatnot. So if you're fishing in the general area of the islands, you didn't have very far to go. So I'd get up in the morning and I'd weed or I'd pick strawberries. And somebody that was a regular there and tried to save up all of his energy for fishing, stopped and was watching me pulling weeds. And he said, "Ron, why do you bother?" And I just thought, wow, gosh, if I have to explain it, I guess it's Yeah, it's an endless thing, weeding, but anyway, some people get it, some people don't. Well, you know, it was there was it was really a kind of a unique environment, as you might imagine. To give you an example, I was wandering around, and it was a particular time when there was a whole bunch of people. And folks that we'd see regularly, it might have even been a closure or something like that, so there could have been 30 people in the house. And I was just wandering around looking at the little clatches of people talking. And there were five women, and the groups were segregated, men and women. There were a bunch of guys talking. This is in the kitchen. There was a bunch of guys talking, and there were a bunch of women talking. And I walked over to say, I'll just go by the ladies here, see what they're talking about. Well, they're talking about fishing. They're talking about gear. They were talking about, landmarks, and they were talking about fishing. And I thought, well, that's cool. And I walked back to where the guys were, and they were talking about baking bread. Greg was going on about his sourdough, and well, it might not have been sourdough, but he made good bread. It's kind of very eclectic. There was a lot of just a lot of fun. But at the same time, everybody's fishing. You're basically competing with everybody around you, and if fishing's not good, people get a little stressed, and you get tired because you're 16-hour days working hard. So it wasn't uncommon for people to get a little short, but generally it was a lot of fun. I guess a community should be a lot of fun. Had a nice volleyball court, croquet. Wasn't like Club Med, because there was always stuff to do. Totally different in the wintertime, because it'd only be you or you and a couple of other people.
You were there in the winter times.
Yeah, a couple of years. When we when the year that the winter that Reba, Greg, and I were there, Greg, I can't remember if Greg left to go crabbing or something. But at that time, you still had folks from Hoonah, young men from Hoonah coming to hunt and fish in the area, kind of thing. And some kind of hermity sort of fishermen. God, I can't remember the guy's name now. But yeah, some guy on the Nestabee, that was the name of his fishing boat. He'd come and just park in the back of the hobbit hole. And he'd hang out there all by himself, and sometimes we'd get three or four young men from Hoonah, the Mills brothers in particular, would come and to go deer hunting. They really like to deer hunt around here. So you weren't always alone. I remember Reba and I were there. We used kerosene lanterns and stuff back then, and primarily wood stove and all of that, and the only other people on the island was at the time was Lane Ply over here in Indian Cove. So Reeb and I are sitting in the front room reading or doing whatever we were doing, and there's a knock on the door, and it's pitch black, and we were both just jerked out of our seats. I mean, we might have even jumped up and hugged each other in fear. It's like, who in the hell is going to knock on your door here in the middle of the night? Well, it was Lane, who, and he had only been there for a little while. He had decided that he was going to hump over the island for a little visit, and he got a little disoriented, which can happen very, very easily, and ended up having to walk around the whole end of the island to get to the.
He walked.
Yeah, he walked. It was fairly early in the day when he started, but he got trapped by the tide, and that learning experience. Yeah, so it'd be could be pretty interesting.
Did the hobbits interact with Lane very much?
Oh, first, yeah, originally. Lane and his wife's name now escapes me, as does his son's, who is a really cool kid. I think he still is. Yeah, they just got kind of, I don't know. I haven't seen him or talked to Lane in years. But I heard that they were pretty protective of their area and tried to run people off and that kind of stuff. Which it happens, I guess.
So for you, besides all those projects you were doing and work, what were your favorite things to do that weren't work? Things for fun?
I enjoy those things. I like physical labor. What else? Well, just tramping around in the woods was always fun. Rowboats. If there was a rowboat around, I'd cruise around in that. Deer hunting in season. Wasn't big on sport fishing. When I was fishing, that's pretty much all you did. Yeah, there was nothing in particular. I mean, one winter I thought I'd do some trapping. And I caught my cat. Didn't quite catch Ephraim. He was a big cat, but it was just a mink trap, but he stuck his face in it. And I said, God, I wonder what tripped that little trap. And one of the traps I didn't, the animal, an otter, probably ran off with it. I didn't have it staked properly. And then, but when I came home, back to the house about 3 or 4 days later, after I found that one, out of a string of maybe 15 mink traps, one of them had been touched off. And I noticed that Ephraim had a big nose, was all swollen, and he had a little bark on the top of his head. So I thought, well, that's not going to work. So, because he would go tramping around in the woods and that kind of thing. So, I wasn't really into the whole idea of skinning them and, doing all that kind of stuff. Yeah, mostly just beating around in the woods. After I got married and had to get serious about earning money, I fished. And then in the spring and the fall, I was an assistant guide with Paul Johnson. Did
Guide
that.
for.
Bears and deer, birds, fish, whatever. I did that for maybe 3 years at the most. Didn't like it though. Never really liked trophy hunting. Never liked it. Wasn't really wild about trophy hunters either for the most part. Although some of them were really nice guys. It just was a matter of being there. There was always places to go, things to see.
And where did you live when you were there?
Depending on the time of the year and the time, in the wintertime, would sleep in the what was then called the what did they call it? It's the pantry room, had a little bunk in it. We're upstairs in the warehouse. People slept up there. When I was fishing, I slept on the boat. Tents, whatever. Literally. But mostly on the boat once I was fishing. Because you had all your stuff there. And it was usually warm. It smelled bad, but usually warm. That's not true.
And were your the gardens ornamental or food or both?
Both, yeah. A lot of energy went into the food portion of it. But it was, Jane did a great job, and Kim was a great gardener too, for that matter. But it wasn't the friendliest area. Didn't have that bad of slugs, bugs, and stuff. But they definitely needed a fair amount of tending, which Kim and Jane did.
Kim spent time fishing too, though. But it was never enough. I mean, it was just kind of, I don't know how much was spent on groceries to feed the folks when they were there. But Greg, I think Greg probably took on a lot of that burden. But then, whenever I came in from town, I'd bring a load of groceries and I'd make people pony up. There were some who were a little more frugal than others. Yeah, I didn't really have any, there was just always something to keep you busy.
Would you say that most of the food you ate there came from the gardens or from what they fished or what they hunted?
Well, fish and meat, yeah. No, there was a lot of it that came from the mainland.
Mm.
Either from Melton Cove, I mean, flour, rice, beans, things of that nature, but there was a lot of subsistence food consumed in the, you know, fish and venison and clams and all that kind of stuff, yeah. Prawns, crab. You used to eat a lot of crab. So a lot of that stuff was right there. And lettuce, spinach, berries, all of that stuff. You know, we experimented with it all. You know, we made sausage and sauerkraut and fruit leather and all that stuff. We were later day hippies, by and large.
And throughout this time, you were making the calendars.
I had been, yeah. Right. Me and Reba and Van when he was there, yeah.
Could you describe what the calendars were?
Well, they were just brief, illustrated, brief descriptions of what may or may not have happened that day with an illustration of some sort that might or might not be related to what happened that day. They were doodles. It was all just doodling. The calendar started just because we didn't have any calendars. And then once the calendar was made, there was some intent to kind of like maintain a little diary or something like that, weather, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And then after a while, it just became an entertainment for a handful of people that were, oh, what happened today? That was big fun or whatever.
And had you done a lot of art before that or doodling?
Doodling? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a chronic doodler. Mm-hmm. But that's about the extent of it for the most part. And it was entertaining for other people, so yeah. Why not? So there's quite a bit of whimsy and fantasy. Probably I haven't looked at it in decades, so.
So you said you started to, once you got married, then you were trying to earn more money. Is that when you started moving away from the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah, after a while I had to, basically. You know, to the best of seasons as a deck monkey, you don't get a lot, you know. Well, you could, but even still with a family of four and all of that goes with it. So I think that was the last year I might have gotten Greg and Fred in a little trouble with the Forest Service, but it was Shantyville. I had made a fabricated structure for myself, Barb, and our two daughters, and the turtle to stay in when I was out fishing with Dennis. Sometimes Barb would go out fishing with us too. The girls would stay on the beach. Peggy and Dennis at that point in time also had a float house on the beach. And I think we only did that for 1 year. Dennis and Peggy, when they had three kids, Annie and twins, it was just too much. I think Peggy probably felt that she was, it was almost a burden on the rest of the community to have her and her squalling brats. No, just kidding. Her kids. So they towed their float home over to Elephant Cove and started living there and got a place up on the beach. Because Dennis would be gone for days on end at times.
And Dennis is Barbara's brother.
Yeah. So we did the Shantyville thing for a year. I think it was the next year after that. I really wanted to. Barb and I were coming up from Alaska. I mean, from Washington, and I really wanted to get back to Alaska. So I got a job with the state. That was soon after we got married, I think, 94, 95. And after that, I just went to the Hobbit Hole seasonally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a week here, a week there. Big parties, Remembrance Day, all sorts of things.
What do you think was the most challenging thing for you living at the Hobbit Hole?
Challenging thing for me. We got the Hobbit Hole.
Or like, what did you wish could have been different?
You know, honestly, I can't think of a thing. It was Nope. Can't think of a thing. Everything was just a hoot. It's hard. I'll give you, now it is anyway. So we made the switch from strictly wood to actually having oil heat. So that was fairly early on. Reba was still there, and Greg and I, and It was a couple of winters in a row where we had serious snow, big snow and big wind and all this other stuff. And pretty sure I was the only one there, but Greg, I think Greg and Reba both had gone either into town with Don Kalk on the Osprey, or Greg might have been going fishing. I can't remember the certain, but I was there alone, and we had a 55-gallon drum on the beach. But it had snowed like heck, and a lot of snow, like 3 feet of snow. So I had to dig all the way from the front door of the house down to the high tide line where it took me all day. So you'd get up, because we were using kerosene lights and stuff. We didn't have electricity. You'd stay in bed for a long time and get up and do stuff when it was daylight. So anyway, I dug all the way down to the beach to roll this 55-gallon drum back up, and I thought, screw it. It took me all day. I was beat. I said, screw it, I'll do it in the morning. Well, it blew that night and filled it all in. So I had to dig it out again and then roll it up. But even stuff like that now seems like that was okay. We had just heaps of snow. Van came deer hunting at the time, and he carved little altars of different sorts. So he had a deer altar, he had made a snow deer that had a little rack and actually had deer legs sticking out of it and stuff. So, you know, everything was fun. I think that's what I remember the most about it. Everything seemed to be fun. There were times when we'd get mad at each other about something, or somebody would get pissy or stupid, but overall it was a hoot.
Do you think that's what you miss most about living there?
Oh, the hootiness? The fun? Well, I honestly don't miss anything about living there.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it thoroughly. I'm really grateful to Greg and Fred that they let me hang around there as long as they did. No, not anything I can really think of that would have made it any better. Fewer slugs, perhaps. That would have been okay. Fewer slugs.
And this is a question that Deborah wanted me to ask you. She asked if you ever had any sort of vision for what the Hobbit Hole was.
You know, I don't think I did. From the standpoint of envisioning it as something other than what it was. I never
thought it was going to be an old folks home for all the old hobbits.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you spend enough time at a place and you think, oh gosh, we could just convert the upstairs of the warehouse into bunks for all the old farts and we just all go out the way we came in. But no, there's just so many extraordinary days there. You know, the one thing that is interesting about the Hobbit Hole is, in its own right, it is wonderful, but it does not have a lot of cool scenery from there. You got to get some elevation in order to see stuff. But at the same time, you have glorious sunsets and whatnot. So I think that whole hemmed-in-ness of the Indian Islands, of the Hobbit Hole itself, almost encourages you to go out into it. Didn't spend heaps of time, you know, once you got the gardening done or once you got whatever you're doing done, you went out on the water and went to other places like to Dundas Bay or over to Taylor Bay or over to Indian Peninsula or up Idaho Inlet. I think that central quality of the Indian Islands gave you access to so much area that is so exceptional that I think that's one of the special things about it. You can go up to top of the North Island and watching clouds being made, and watching, you know, the flow of the whole Pacific Ocean through the through this little archipelago, and yeah, it's like so many places in Alaska. One of a kind.
So tell me about life in Juneau.
I don't know what life in Juneau is like. I live in Douglas.
In Douglas. What is the difference between Douglas and Juneau? Is Douglas not technically part of Juneau?
Well, it is, but it's all part of the city and borough, but Douglas is a booming town before Juneau was back in the day. And it's just a parochial thing, you know. Juneau, the gateway to Douglas. Everybody says, oh, it blows over in Juneau because the Taku winds and stuff. Well, it blows over Juneau because it blows in Douglas because it sucks in Juneau. You know? No, it's just silliness. But, well, the thing I like about living here is that I can just walk 50 feet out my door and be in the woods, be in the forest, and walk another mile or two and I'm someplace I've never been before. So that's what it is for me. It's just having that opportunity, even if I don't employ it as often as I used to. You know, it's still there. You know, it's like in my brother-in-law's place out at Indian Islands. It's all still there. It hasn't gone anywhere. And knowing that it is very fulfilling. I like the option of staying close to home, but still having, you know, the world right there, if you want to look for it.
And that's how you feel here?
Yeah, definitely. I can't. I've never lived in a community with more than 30,000 people in it. And many of the places I've lived had fewer than that in it, some of them anyway. So I'm not at all enthralled about what big cities have to offer. I only go to big cities so that I can go to some place nearby that's not a big city.
Is Douglas an island?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel like islands have been a theme.
Oh, you. Yeah, I like islands, without a doubt. Um, There's a very calming attitude about being around the water, and being surrounded by it is just kind of nice. And water and mountains, islands with mountains on them, are very special.
Well, unless there's anything else you want to add.
I can't think of anything, although I am curious if there was something that Deborah envisioned that the Hobbit Hole might be other than what it is. It seems to me that it's kind of ending up in a good spot.
Have you been back there since the house and Jane sold it?
I've been there twice, I think. Yeah, twice. I went over to get, I think I went over there to see Coulter and take him some fish. But yeah, only twice. And last time I was there, thought about it but didn't get there. Something at Dennis's got in the way. Probably a fallen tree. No, I have nothing more that I can think of other than I hope everybody that goes there enjoys it as much as most of us did.
Well, thank you very much, Ron.
My pleasure.